So I'm gonna. This talk is not gonna be. Unfortunately, I'm not gonna tell you any main results of like how what are the forces that drive morphogenetic movements. Not yet. We are working on that in my lab. So I'm gonna tell you about what I started at Harvard and I finished here on the technique that we created to measure forces in vivo. The goal is to understand the physics of tissues live in the embryo when they are shaping structures. Okay. So this is actually a talk that is gonna be mostly technical, I would say. Well, not technical. I'm not going to go to all the details, but it's going to be about a method actually to measure forces. Okay. So before I get into that, I want to tell you a little bit of what we've worked on in the past. So when I was in Curie, as Christina mentioned, I worked mostly at cellular level, intercellular level, and I was working more on how cellular movements are generated at the molecular scale, so collective behavior of molecular motors and these kind of things. And then when I arrived at Harvard for my postdoc, I started working on problems related to morphogenesis, like cell shaping organisms that have cell wall, like bacteria, fungal species, or plants. And then I work on the beaks of Darwin finches. I know this looks weird. This was my first experimental kind of work. I mean, I just needed to go to a museum and take pictures of the beaks of the bird. So that was not actually that complicated. But actually, no, that's not really true. I did a little part of the developmental biology associated to that, but it was my first work. So anyway, but it was about the scaling of beak shapes in Darwin finches, and we find actually nice groups that, like, literally like groups in mathematics. Commutative groups actually can describe the morphological variation in the beaks. What's that?
It was the original Darwin finches, if you say you go to the museum.
Well, I mean, it was not the original Darwin finches, but yeah, that's good.
So,
and now actually we're, well, this started again at Harvard actually, but what my lab is mostly interested in is about trying to map all the force fields during tissue morphogenesis in the early embryos, okay? So today I'm going to focus only on this part. Okay, so as you all know, I'm sure that you're familiar with that, morphogenesis have many different flavors. So there are many different approaches that have been used to study morphogenesis. I'm not going to give you now a huge review on the different approaches, but I'm just going to mention some. So many people in biology have been studying the signaling pathways, and the reason why they study signaling pathways is because these are the molecules that are used actually for cell-cell communication, and cell-cell communication obviously is what cells use to self-organize. So many people have studied that. This is mostly biochemical work. It's more like trying to understand what are the molecules involved, how they generate the spatial gradients, etc., etc. Then other people have been more interested in understanding how these signals lead to specific cell types in a particular location in the embryo. And that is more trying to understand the gene regulatory networks. It's kind of like the cell integrates the signals, and this kind of the computer that decides what is going to become that cell. And then other techniques, and these are probably the oldest techniques because they don't require much except for cutting and pasting the embryo that almost anyone can do. I can do it, so almost everyone can do it. So you take a part of an embryo, and you can take it off and graft it onto another embryo. And by doing this kind of experiments, you can learn about what are the instructive signals that some cells in the embryo have. And in particular, this is the Spearman organizer experiment. It dates actually about 100 years ago, a little more, that he showed that there was a part of the Xenopus embryo, the frog embryo, that you could take off, graft it in another embryo, and that would have the instructive signals to generate an entire body axis. Okay. Actually, if you guys are familiar with Boots Hall, do you know Boots Hall School? No? It's mostly biology, so probably physicists are not used to it. But in Boots Hall, actually, when I did the developmental biology course, we had a competition of who was the person actually who get actually more axes in the frog. Actually, and the one who won got six. So not bad, actually. Anyway, so these are mostly molecular approaches. You want to understand what are the molecules involved in setting patterns in the embryo today. Then there are more, I would say, more coarse-grained approaches, which is trying to understand what is the role of cell behavior. And by cell behavior, I understand cell divisions, both the rate of divisions or the isotropy of the division axis or like the patterning of division events in the embryo, etc. On cellular movements, local cell anisotropy, how are all these issues influencing the largest scale morphogenetic movements that shape tissues, okay? And then there is even a more coarse-grained approach that has been actually, I would say, neglected for a long time, and now actually it's taking off thanks to you guys, I would say, which is trying to understand the embryo more as a material that has the ability to shape itself. It's a complex material, but it's a material nonetheless. Okay. However, I'm going to argue this is not a material like the table, in the sense that the table is kind of it has homogeneous material properties. Here, the material properties in the embryo, in a real embryo, are non-homogeneous. They are fields of material properties that change as a function of space and time. And these experiments, these are in vitro experiments with groups of cells that can help a lot understand some of the basic physical properties of the tissues, but this does not help us understand the patterning of mechanics in the embryo. Okay? So if you're like me, or at least this is actually what I'm interested in, is I want to relate this side of the story, so this, the physical aspects of embryonic development, to the genetics aspects, to what are the genes actually that pattern the structures and how they generate the morphogenetic flows. And in order to understand the complete story, you need to understand how they drive the physical fields that generate those morphogenetic movements. So why do we care about mechanics at all in biology? That's I think it's worth going into that, actually, because it is not obvious at all that one should care about mechanics. So I'm just going to give you first some examples of why we believe it's important, or some experiments that show that it's important, and then I'll tell you why I think it's more relevant than many, at least that people have believed so far. So these are the experiments that you've probably seen now many times in this conference. These are by Xavi in Barcelona. Well, actually, he did that when he was at Harvard. And it shows the pattern of attraction forces on a substrate that the colony of cells is doing when it moves. And what he showed that is very nice is that in the absence of any chemical signaling, you can actually have larger scale, so long-range correlations between the velocity, inside the velocity field. So in other words, the cells flock all together with a range of about 22 cell to 30 cell length, which is a lot, actually. So you can kind of organize the cellular movements without the need of having any instructive signal from outside. And that, by the way, it's only because of the forces, the intercellular forces. Now, this is a work by Manuel Terry and co-workers, actually, where they showed that the orientation of the spindle axis actually depends on the cellular forces as well, on the forces surrounding the cell. There's another work, actually, by the group in Curie, by the people in Curie, that show that the rate of cell proliferation also depends on the forces, in particular, in this case, only the pressure applied to the aggregate. And there is this work that also probably most of you know that shows that the differentiation of the stem cells can be directed also with the mechanics of the substrate. Okay? Now, I'm not going to get into the details because Dave Waits was discussing what that could be actually because of changes in the volume of the cell. It could be, actually, but at the end of the day, whether indirect or direct, what we know is that you change the mechanics of the substrate and it changes the differentiation state. Okay? But so all these are experiments that kind of show that physical forces are relevant for cell behavior. But for me, the most important experiment was the one done by Emmanuel Farge in Curie
2 years ago,
where he showed that if you apply local forces in the embryo, you can induce gene expression that is necessary to generate the morphogenetic flows and the patterning in the embryo. So the reason why I'm saying this is important is because you can think of physics in biology as playing a purely passive role. So there are the genes make the proteins that generate some cell behavior, they generate some forces that build the structure, but it's kind of just a single path, and the mechanics is just an outcome of the genetics actually that just makes the structures. However, the fact that you can induce gene expression by applying local forces means that there is a feedback loop, and that you need actually to understand that feedback loop, and it's a self-contained system that you cannot understand only by just looking at the genetics. So this is why I think that these experiments are key, because it means that we need to actually understand the system as a whole, as many of us actually probably believe. So all this knowledge actually comes from, or most of this knowledge comes from
you said it was actually a pressure.
It's a pressure.
So okay, on what? On a 3D?
You just have an aggregate of cells, 3D, and then you, if you want, I can explain you the details, but essentially you have a dialysis membrane, you put PEG or any other molecule that is going to create an osmotic difference, and then actually that generates a global pressure on the aggregate, and by changing the osmotic pressure, actually you can tell
And you can
observe the division rate, and then actually it tells you actually that there is an influence. Okay.
It's a very global
measurement on an aggregate, but it's one of the most quantitative experiments showing actually that there is an influence between pressure and cell division. So all these results actually were done because people actually developed techniques to measure forces in vitro. In vitro, I mean, you all know what it means in vitro, right? You take the cells off the embryo, you put it, not even that actually, you have a cell type actually in the lab, and you have a dish and you put the cells in there, and then you can measure these forces, okay? But it's all in a dish. And if you think that you want to understand the mechanics actually that shapes the structures in the embryo, one has to be very careful in using these things, okay? Yeah.
Do you measure forces? But did he measure the applied forces?
They put ferrofluid locally in the embryo, and they pull. And what they did is generate. So actually, to be fair, what they do is first a knockout actually to eliminate the morphogenetic movements that happen in the embryo. Then they put the ferrofluid, pull on it, and then you see that you recover the gene the endogenous gene expression. But there is no measure of the force.
Did you measure actually force?
No. It's just like, it could be, you're totally right, that what it could be is that they apply too much force or something and something weird is happening. It could be, formally. It could be. But it kind of, it goes in the direction that it may be important. So you probably hear about this, so I'm going to go very quickly over it. There are different techniques to measure forces in vitro, and I want to emphasize that. So
this is traction force microscopy.
You can do traction force microscopy in a single cell. That was the original experiment. Cell monolayers, like Chavi Trepat actually showed last week, or even in 3D geometries, you can embed the cells in gels and then do traction force microscopy in 3D. Okay, but remember, it is a cell that you put in artificial gel. Okay, then there are micropillar techniques that are also very widely used, and they are very interesting as well. That can also be used for a single cell or for a cell monolayer. Then people have used a lot of micropipette respiration to measure global properties of aggregates of cells. This is in Curie as well, a group of François Borchard, and also to measure adhesion between cells. Okay, they quantify the adhesion properties between cells. And now, more recently, people have developed these FRET force sensors. This is very exciting, actually. It's a very exciting work because what they do is they put a FRET sensor in the molecules actually that are going to resist the forces, like for instance in this case it's vinculin that happens at cell adhesions, it's expressed at cell adhesions, and also actually you can fuse it to cadherins and then see the intercellular forces. Now, the idea is that you can correlate the FRET signal to the force. That is not obvious at all. Okay, so people have had a lot of trouble relating the FRET signal here. So you see this FRET index. It doesn't tell you quantitatively the force, and that is tricky. And even in culture, it's less tricky than do it in vivo. In vivo, actually, the first preliminary experiments by Denise Montel, who's here in Santa Barbara, they've managed to do it in vivo, but the measurements of the force are not very quantitative, and it's very difficult to calibrate the system. I hope actually they manage to do it, because it would be nice. What's that?
How is it supposed to couple the force?
So what you have is... Yeah, it's distance. You have a FRET sensor, and you know actually that the intensity of the signal depends on the distance between the end of this. You put essentially a spacer, or a molecule that is going to act as a linear spring, and then the distance actually tells you about the force that is in there, and the distance is reflected in the FRET signal. Okay, but saying that in theory, it's, we all understand that doing that and checking that. You know quantitatively what is the measure value of the force. It's way more complicated, actually, and it's not been done yet. So it's only tensile forces, only tensile forces, because obviously you need to pull on that molecule. So
pressure.
So for instance, here they are giving you the FRET signal on the focal adhesions, actually, that they sell. So probably there are stress fibers. You can see stress fibers here, and you have the focal adhesions, and you can see that there is a signal around here. Okay, this is what they say. But it's very, I think it's exciting. I think if this works well, actually it's going to be great. And then there are other techniques like AFM and this kind of things.
But
so these in vitro techniques have helped us a lot, but the problem is that you can only use them in vitro with culture cells, but you cannot use them in vivo. So what is that that we can do for in vivo? So there's only one technique at this moment, and it's not to measure forces. And I'm going to explain in a second why you cannot measure forces with this technique. It's only to perturb the mechanical state of the embryo. So, but let me explain you how people have used it so far. So you take this is an epithelium of the fly, and you can see here it's a fusion Ekaterin GFP, so you're seeing actually cell cell junctions, and you shine a femto laser to one of the junctions here, and you cut the junction, and that is easy to say, it's very tricky to do, but you can cut it properly, and then actually you can see a relaxation. Okay, let me show you an example.
This is done in the lab.
You can see here,
we shoot the femto laser.
So, yeah. Probably you realize that, what is the junction that I'm shooting? This one here, thing, okay? And you can see that when you shoot, it retracts, and actually, sometimes it regrows, okay?
What do you actually do there? You destroy the silent brain?
So that's the key one, actually, and this is where I don't like laser ablation. I shouldn't say that, but I don't really like it because you need to make sure that you destroy the cytoskeleton so that you release the cortical tension, but if you don't want to break the membrane. You don't want to make a hole and cut everything. And that actually, and that depends on the power of the laser that you use, which depends on the depth of the tissue, because you need to go in and make a focus of the laser there. So it's actually extraordinarily tricky to have quantitative experiments with this.
So
you can cut easily, but...
So what's the white membrane there?
So this is not membrane, sorry. What I'm labeling here...
No. The
a priori, yes. So what you do to make sure that it's there is you lower the laser power until the minimum so that you can see the retraction, but then actually you see the cortex regrow. But that actually, it's tricky because how do you know
that you catch
everything if it's regrowing? So it's a little bit tricky to do. But people have done it. Pierre Franchalen and Matteo Rauzi and these people actually have done very controlled experiments with this in Drosophila. So, and you can do that at single cell level, you can do that in a tissue. You can make a giant cut, okay? Now, what is the problem with this? So you cannot, when I'm saying that you cannot quantify the stresses in the system is for the following reason. So if you have the stresses are related to strain rates or to strains through actually the mechanical properties, G prime, G double prime, actually here. Everyone knows what it is, essentially it's the mechanical property of the tissue. It could be more complicated than that. It could depend also on a yield stress, depending on the properties of the mechanical properties of the tissue.
However,
let me make it simple for this for the time being. Imagine actually that we have that we could describe the cell-cell junction with a simple relation like this. And this is the cortical force that you have just before you cut it, and this is the velocity of retraction just after you cut it. Okay? So we know, well, many people have used these kind of expressions. The problem is that you can measure the velocity of retraction by looking at the retraction of the junction, but you cannot measure the local friction force, the local viscosity in the environment. It can be inhomogeneous, it can be anisotropic, it can depend on different portions of the embryo, so you have no idea. So you cannot quantify the force. That is it. And then people, what they do is they say, no, I can't quantify the force because I'm going to make the ratio of this expression in one junction and in another junction, and I'm going to eliminate the friction coefficient because I cannot measure that. I'm not going to comment on that. You actually can take conclusions. So it is a great technique to perturb the mechanical state. You can do it at subcellular level, cellular level, tissue level. It's great for that. It is not a good technique to quantify. So how do we measure the forces in situ? In situ, I mean locally at the cell level. In a
so for that, we use oil droplets as force transducers. And the idea is
very simple. Imagine you have droplets like this, tiny oil droplets, okay, below the capillary length. I'm going to explain actually now what if some of you know what the capillary length is, right? Okay. So you have the droplets here, and then you have a tissue here. I'm sketching just the cell borders, okay? Here. So the idea is, it's very simple, is you want to put a droplet in between the cells, and you want the cells to be able to adhere to this droplet and to be able to push and pull on the droplet. And if you can push and pull on the droplet, essentially it's going to deform the droplet, and we know the physics of a droplet, and if you can measure the mechanical properties of this drop, we can essentially recover in 3D the stresses that the cells surrounding the drop are applying. That is easy to say, it's a little more tricky to do. So what I'm showing you here is a confocal section of one of the droplets that we use. Actually, we labeled the surface fluorescently. I'm going to tell you in a second how. But essentially, it has to have several features, this drop. It cannot be the oil that you have in the kitchen, for instance. This was the first thing that I tried. No, actually, I tried that, and it works. The problem is that the oil goes all over the cell membranes because it's the same. These are hydrocarbons, so these are phospholipids, the oil that you have in the kitchen, so they go on the cell membranes of all. So you don't know what you're changing, essentially. So you cannot use that. So it needs to be an oil that is immiscible in water and in vegetable oils. It cannot mix with cell membranes. So we use for that fluorinated oils. And the reason why we use fluorinated oils is because they are extraordinarily biocompatible. They are actually used as blood substitutes if you have a problem in your blood. We put emulsions of fluorinated oils. So we use this. The other thing actually that is important is that you have to be, the drops have to be smaller than the capillary length for the physical properties of this oil. And our drops are well below the capillary length. It's just because you don't want, I mean, you're trying to measure forces active from drop deformation. You don't want gravity to be deforming the drop. So you need to control the interfacial tension. You need to fluorescently label the droplet. And you need to specifically coat the droplet with ligands for cell adhesion receptors. You want the cells to be able to pull. Okay, so this is the idea. You just want the droplet coated with the cell adhesion receptors that you have in a particular cell type that you are interested in. Okay? So anyway, so we've done this. If somebody's interested, we can discuss, or you can check the paper, actually, which is already out. But the first experiment that we did is very simple, actually. I just took droplets, an emulsion of these droplets, already coated with ligands for cell adhesion receptors and everything. And I mix it with cells, and then I compact this, and I make a cellular aggregate. This is a cellular aggregate with the drops inside. Then I use confocal or two-photon or SPIM or whatever technique you like most, actually, to do three reconstructions. And you actually then reconstruct the shape of the droplet in three dimensions. Okay. So I did that with two different cell types. And these, again, these are cells in the lab. This is not yet embryos. Go ahead.
Is this trivial? Can you just take a droplet? I mean, the pauses in the cell have to be just appropriate to form the cell.
That's the key point, actually. The reason why I thought of using droplets is because if you know that, so what stresses do you need to deform the drop? You need, actually, the stresses are very high. Formally, they're very high because the pressure inside the drop is very similar to the pressure outside, which is an atmosphere. So essentially, the cells are never going to form an atmosphere. However, and that's going to come back later. But however, the forces actually to deform the interface are way smaller, are on the order of the surface tension divided by the radius of the drop. And you know the surface tensions of oils, it's in the millinewton per meter range. And you know that these droplets are about 20 microns. 10 microns, so you know that it's on the range of nanonewtons per micron square, and we know that nanonewtons per micron square are the forces, roughly speaking, that we've seen in vitro.
How do you know that the cell-droplet interactions are comparable to cell-cell interactions?
Good point. We don't know. Good point. We don't know.
You couldn't do the same thing, but with like taking one cell from an embryo, measuring the
right.
Feed it back or something.
So the thing is, like, you're right. Actually, what we're trying to do now is to make the surface of the droplet. We can coat it with any molecules that we want, any. Not only any ligands, or we can actually, now we're coating them with signaling molecules. So we can coat them with essentially whatever we want that we can biotinylate, which is essentially all proteins that you want, almost. So we are trying now to make the surface of the droplets more similar to another cell. And actually, it's very funny. If you put adhesion, too many adhesion receptors on the surface, what happens is that they phase segregate because of differential adhesion. So,
since, for example, a point force gives you a change in shape all over the droplet, it's a non-trivial exercise to invert the shape.
Good point, yeah. It's a global coupling on the droplet, actually, because you have volume conservation.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I'll show you in a second. Okay.
So, how do you sure they want some stuff from the cells?
And changes the surface tension. Yeah, that is actually what's my main concern. So what we've done actually is we saturate with PEG the surface. So we put actually surfactants and we saturate with PEG to avoid non-specific interactions. And then we incubate these droplets with cell culture media, with the culture media that the cells are going to live in. And actually there is a lot of adsorption because in cell culture media is not like an embryo or something like this. There is a lot of things in there. There's a lot of like well, the main component is VSA. But VSA is a surfactant. So what it does, the VSA gets absorbed onto the interface, and then it kind of blocks the rest of the interface, okay, in between the packs. So it is, there is so much concentration of VSA and things there that when you put the droplet in between the cells, we expect actually to change it. So what I'm, in other words, what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to saturate the surface so that if something goes that is relevant, it will change the surface tension just a teeny bit, the interfacial tension. But it's true, it's a good point actually. And now we're looking for methods to measure the surface tension in vivo. But that is a nightmare. If you have ideas on that, I mean, I've tried like so many things already. Anyway, so these are tooth mesenchymal cells, these are mammary epithelial cells, these are different cell types. So here, oh, by the way, the important point to mention here, these are primary cells. Okay, this is important. Primary cells means cells that have been taken out from the embryo and plated. It's not that you have a cell line that you buy and it's been like lots of generations that you don't know if that looks like any cell in the embryo, okay? So we have transfected these with GFP reporter, so we can see them fluorescently in this hydroplasm. And here we didn't have any GFP reporter for this one, so what we did is we label the nuclei. So what you're seeing is the nuclei of the cells. Okay, these are blue things are the nuclei of the cells, and the red thing is the interface of the drop. Okay, so in this case, the droplets are coated with RGD peptide. The RGD peptide is just the binding domain of fibronectin. So the integrins are going to attach to this thing on the surface of the drop, and the other one is coated with icadilin antibodies to target icadilin. On the surface of the cells, okay? So now let me explain. So the first thing that, the thing that I wanted to point out on this slide, I totally forgot, is that you see drop deformations. And you can say, well, yeah, so what? This actually for me was, I tried it the first time and I saw drop deformations. I was very happy about that because it could be that you are totally wrong on the scale of the surface tension, and then you don't see any deformation whatsoever. And changing surface tension, once you've saturated the surface, it is a nightmare, which we did. I'll tell you how. But it is a nightmare, actually. So let me tell you how you recover now that we have drop deformations, the forces. Okay? So you have a drop, and this is the physics for a drop that is spherical and is not deformed by gravity. That's very simple. It's the internal pressure, external pressure, and this is the Laplace jam at the interface. But now when it's deformed, you have the internal pressure, which may be different. In general, it's different. The external pressure, which may be different, but actually it's not in general, but it's okay. I'll put it different. And this is the Laplace jump, but I brought it as H. H is the mean curvature, as you're going to say. I'm just going to put it. And here, you have the stresses. These are the normal stresses that the cells are applying on the surface of the drop. Okay? So what I'm writing here is nothing else than local force balance in the normal direction. Okay? It's an extended Laplace, if you want. So the mean curvature, by the way, I define it here like this. You can define it in different ways. And I take these coordinates to parameterize the surface of the drop. Okay? So the stresses that you're seeing here, I put the explicit dependence on theta and phi because these actually depend on the cell that you have around the drop. So it changes. They change on the surface. Okay? And accordingly, if there's a stress that changes, now you're changing the shape of the drop and changes the curvature. Okay? So in order to understand what are the stresses, what we need to understand, what we need to measure is the curvature map on the surface. Now, it's not obvious from here how you recover the forces. At least still for me, it was not obvious. But you can do the following. You can actually decouple the isotropic component of the stresses and the anisotropic component of the stresses. So isotropic means it's a pressure. Okay? And it's not a hydrostatic pressure that comes from the fluid. Actually, there's an isotropic component of the stress that the cells are applying, and it's a tissue pressure that comes from the crowding of the cells around the droplet. Okay? And then you have another component, which is the anisotropic ones, and these are the ones that are thought to drive many morphogenetic movements, okay, like the difference in stresses in one direction compared to another. Okay? And this one you can, well, I'm going to tell you in a second. So, and these are the anisotropic. Then you can actually do exactly the same trick with the curvature. You decouple isotropic and anisotropic components. By the way, isotropic components of the curvature just means changes in radius and the size of the droplet. And anisotropic components means changes in shape. So changes in volume are related to tissue pressure. Changes in shape are related to anisotropic stresses. Now,
you've got oil inside, right?
So we cannot measure the changes in volume. Okay, so I cannot measure the isotropic component of the stress unless I have a part of the surface of the droplet that is uncovered. Because if a part of the surface is not covered by cells, if they are not fully embedded in the tissue, for instance, if they are in an epithelial tissue and they have a sticking cap, then I can use the cap to measure the pressure inside the droplet. And we've done that as well. So we've measured. So, but you can actually write the relation between the anisotropic stresses here and the mean curvature on the surface of the droplet, and it's just it's a very simple relation. Actually, this is exactly equivalent than a linear spring, but in 3D. It's like having a linear spring in every spatial direction. So you have, this is the applied forces. The role of the spring constant is the surface tension, obviously. And then the displacement is the curvature. It's simple as that. So now we need to measure the right-hand side of this equation if we want to measure the stresses. So first we measure the surface tension, and we do it using standard techniques from physics, and again, making sure that we're saturating the surface and then everything is okay. And then we need to measure the mean curvature at every point. So what we do is we do these 3D stacks, we recover the shape in 3D of the drops, then we use B-splines actually to smooth the surface from high-frequency noise at the pixel level, and once we have that, you can actually calculate the mean curvature at every point. So you have the curvature map here, okay? So now that you have that, you go to these aggregates and you make confocal sections, well, 3D reconstructions of the aggregates with the drops inside. You can see the droplets here, not very well, but you can see them. And then you can do exactly what I said and map the stresses on the surface of the droplet. And I'm sorry for the color coding. Apparently the projector is different than my computer. So I just want to notice one thing. In mesenchymal cells, you can see that the scales are different here. It looks like the deformations for mesenchymal cells are, sorry, that the stresses that these mesenchymal cells apply are smaller than for epithelial cells, okay? Obviously, this is one drop, so you don't want to believe anything just from one drop. So, but I want to emphasize one thing here. These are in situ experiments, meaning I'm measuring the forces around a particular cell. Okay? You can measure quantitatively the stresses around one cell. If you want to do statistics, actually, you don't even need to do the 3D. And that looks weird because a priori you need the two you need to measure the two principal curvatures on the surface to measure the local stresses. But if you're doing if you do only 2D confocal sections and you have a lot of statistics and there is no major anisotropy in the tissue, and that's critical, so you cannot have cells all aligned in one direction because that is a major anisotropy. If it's kind of isotropic, the organization of the cells, then the two principal directions are equivalent. It doesn't matter that you're looking at the system in one direction or that you're looking at the system in another direction. And then by just measuring in one direction, you know that the average value of the principal curvatures in both directions is going to be the same, only in isotropic tissues. So if you do that, you can measure actually the average value of the maximal stresses, and you can see that epithelial cells indeed apply forces that are larger. And this is actually commonly believed. Okay, but this is the first experiment in 3D aggregates that you can, so not in 2D layers, artificial 2D layers, it's in 3D aggregates. Now, we wanted a different experiment actually to contrast the values of the force that we were getting, and unfortunately, there's not other one in vivo, but the group of Chris Chen has developed this 3D traction force microscopy that I explained in the beginning, that you can put cells in 3D gel matrices, and they track the stresses, and you can see that the stresses that they get, by the way, this cell type here, it's a fibroblast, these are mesenchymal cells, so they're very similar cells, okay? So you can see that the stresses actually that they measure at the focal adhesions here are about 1.52 kilopascals, and by the way, 1 kilopascal is 1 nanonewton per micron square. So you can see that they are about the same values that we get in our experiments, okay? So
forces that measure single cells in gel.
Oh, I see.
And there you
have
many cells,
yeah.
And you don't
use
gel, but you
liquid. I'm not trying to say that the value 1.5 should be exactly 1.5. I'm just trying to say that they should be in the same order of magnitude. I'm not expecting the cells to develop forces now that are two orders of magnitude different. Or even if it was 15 here, I would be a little bit surprised. No, I mean, it's true. I would like to measure. So now in my lab, we're doing actually a little more careful experiments in the sense that we are taking the drop and measuring within gels what is the with control forces and this thing actually to calibrate the things properly. At that point, actually, we didn't do that, and actually, I have a hard time believing that this is not going to be the case. I believe this is going to be correct, and maybe actually, it's true that maybe the calibration is going to be slightly different, and 1.5 was not true, and it was 1.7, it was 1.8, maybe 2, maybe, but it doesn't really matter now.
You don't have crazy effects. Basically, the bigger force you feel or local pressure is just the action of your neighbor, and so there is no collective.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's the point. That's a very good point, actually. That's a very good point. So these drops are cell sized. I don't know if you see the scale here, but are about 20 microns, 10 microns, 20 microns. You can use bigger drops, and then you start seeing the stress field at the tissue scale. So we change the... now we're doing actual experiments in which we change the size of the drop, and we can actually pick up, we can decouple the modes of deformations at the surface of the drop, and you can show actually that there are fluid modes like of deformation, like if it was drops in shear flow. And then we have, as you go to smaller and smaller drops, when it gets to a particular size of about 2 times the cell size, you start getting actually higher order modes of deformation that come from the discrete nature of the tissue. So you only see the discrete nature when you're at 2 cell level.
Yeah. But I thought Pascal's point was that the forces that like cells like
that may be different. Yeah.
It depends on the 1 hour of fixed value, right?
Actually,
how much
but that's a good point.
But how much of a variation is that? So these are just.
No, it can be a factor of two.
I don't know. Can there be a factor of 10 value?
It's proportional up to a certain level.
Yeah. That is saturated.
Let me tell you that at the end, because what I did is I changed the surface tension of this droplet by 6-fold, and I measured exactly the same forces. In the same conditions, same forces actually, by changing the interfacial tension. You just see, for softer droplets, you just see actually much, much higher deformations, much larger curvatures, but you measure the same force. So that actually is kind of something that I really don't understand yet, actually, because there are all these experiments saying that the cells actually, if you change the substrate, actually they get stronger. I'm not saying this. But anyway, it's okay. So the first thing actually that we want to know is whether these forces are actively generated by cell. I didn't understand why biologists kept telling me actually like these deformations may come from something that is not the cells, and I was like, there's nothing else. I don't see actually why actually this. These are the cells, but they're right. One has to do control experiments properly. So what I did is I kind of destroyed the cells. That was actually the first draft, more rough experiment. You put SDS. SDS is a surfactant that actually makes holes on the cells and spills the content. Just you destroy the cells, okay? And if you do that, you see the following. So these are the drops on the surface. These are embedded. There are cells all over. You cannot see it here very well, but there are cells all over. And you can see the formations, okay? And now I'm going to put SDS, and you're going to see what happens. In 1 second, the drop just round up, okay? The deformations.
Yeah, that's going to look back.
Put it, just round. So that pretty much tells you that it's the cells that are doing the forces. Now, you want to be a little more specific now. So what we did is we went for actin. So we disrupt the actin cytoskeleton. We don't allow it actually to make filaments. Using cytokalasin D. And here are drops. It's a little bit more difficult to see, but here you can see the confocal one. This is before the addition. You can see the drops form after they're round. And I'm going to show you the video for fun. But you should look at a closer version of this video to see it happening. The one that I want to show you that's the more interesting is what happens if you inhibit myosin II. So you now take the actin cytoskeleton is OK, and you just inhibit myosin II using bladistatin. And now here you see the droplets nicely deform on the surface, okay? And now I'm going to put the blebistatin, and you're going to see what happens. Oh, sorry, yeah. It's slower. It takes actually about 10 minutes to get in and make the effect. But you can see when you put it in, it's like you can feel actually if you're in the microscope, actually you can see like everything like getting dropped. Yeah. So. Oh no, that's because I'm three-dimensional in vivo. I have the dish with the cells and everything, and I'm scanning in the confocal. I was doing confocal at the same time. And you go with the drug and you put it in the dish. You can do perfusion if you want, I thought, but I just was trying to do it. Huh? You just put it at the final concentration that you want, and you just and I'm pipetting up and down to make it swirl, like to make it to mix. And then actually you can see, this is why you see a flow in the beginning. Right? Yeah. So what about in vivo? So all that I said so far, it doesn't get much better than in vitro techniques, maybe a little bit, but doesn't get much better. So in vivo, it's a little bit more difficult. And for that, actually, for these experiments, we chose to use mouse. And in particular, we chose to measure the forces that occur during tooth development in mouse. Now, this is the worst system that you can use, the worst. I mean, if somebody told me, like, pick up the worst system, I probably would have seen this one. But because
there is a reason for that,
because mice actually are not transparent. Live tissue in mouse is extraordinarily thick optically, and this is an optical technique. You need to see the drop, all right? So you don't want to do that. But it turns out, actually, that I had money to do tooth development, so I had to do that. Anyway, this is how it happens. On the
outside, actually, if you manage to do it here,
you can do it in almost any tissue, almost any embryo. Now in my lab we use zebrafish for obvious reasons. Actually, it's transparent. So, but at the point I didn't have access to that. Anyway, so what we do is we take the mouse embryo, and we dissect out the entire mandible. Okay, you can keep this mandible alive and growing for about 24 hours, between 15 to 24 hours. And then actually, what we do is we microinject. We took microinjection needles and we microinject these droplets. We can make one at a time at different locations of the tissue, okay? And then you let it grow for some time. And I don't know if you've ever seen an embryonic tissue, but it heals extraordinarily fast. So you make a hole, and just like after like half an hour to an hour, the hole is not there, and everything is repaired. So at the early stages, for us, it's a little bit more complicated. So it would be great, obviously, if you can see the cells. If you just have tissue that you cannot see anything, it's a little bit more complicated. So what we did is we used a genetic trick. We crossed two mice to obtain a mouse actually that would have the membranes of almost all cells, all cells in the body, showing the membranes labeled in red in almost all the cells in the embryo except for the epithelium. And in the epithelium, the membranes are going to be green. Okay, so let me show you.
This is a confocal section through a tooth bud in the mandible.
And that you can really not see almost anything apparently, but can you see something? But here you can see nicely the columnar epithelium. You can see the columnar cells here in the epithelium, and then you can see here the cells in the mesenchyme. Okay, and now I'm just gonna. This is not a movie. This is a 3D stack. Okay, through the entire mandible. Let me just play it. You can see the molar. This is the molar structure. By the way, for maybe you've
never seen an embryonic molar,
so that's why I've seen it so many times now that for me it's like kind of obvious. An embryonic molar is like this. So it grows like this, the tooth. You have the tissue, you have an epithelium. It invaginates inside the mesenchyme. This thing actually is going to grow into something like this, then into something like this, and it starts looking more to something that you're more used. It's actually, this is going to be the root of the tooth later on.
So this is actually embryonic tissue, this is that.
And then what happens is when it gets to this stage, there is a self-differentiate and start making the enamel and all that here, and this actually erupts the tooth in this direction. So first it kind of like shapes the tooth by the competition of the mesenchyme and the epithelium, and then actually erupts later. So this is the very, very initial stages of tooth formation. So just to show you the images that we can get here, if you take confocal slices through this is an incisor tooth bud, actually, this one here. This is how the incisor grows. By the way, the mouse only has two molars and two incisors at this stage. It doesn't have anything else. Okay, and you can see that we could actually image very nicely the cells, the shapes of the cells and everything in the embryo. So what you do now is you have this embryo, you microinject the droplets, let it grow, and then you image with the drops. And you can get things like this. So you have the drop now embedded in between the cells in the tissue, and the tissue may grow with the drop inside. Actually, in zebrafish now, we keep it for more than 2 days, and the droplets are inside the tissue, and there is no problem. And now you can do the same that we did for in vitro. So we track the interface at very high resolution. And then from the interface, actually, we can measure the curvatures. And from the curvatures, we can measure
the stresses.
And then you can do statistics on that, on the confocal sections, and show, actually, that the forces that we measure in vivo are these ones here. Now, these cells here are tooth mesenchymal cells in the embryo. Now, the ones that I showed you, as in the beginning I told you, we are measuring tooth mesenchymal cells that are primary cultures. Those were these cells that we took off and we plated in a dish. And with that we made aggregates. So it's the same cell type, just primary, not actually like it's been derived. And then we want to compare the forces. So remember that the forces that we measure in the aggregate of the same cells are this. So by the way, when I give this value, what I mean is the maximal value of the anisotropic stresses. This is the maximal anisotropic stress that they're able to generate. This is not the average, it's the maximal. Now, it looks that they're about the same. And that goes to your question. Why, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And actually, it's very tricky because when I put these droplets, the same droplets that I did in the aggregates, I put it in vivo, I got no deformation. They were absolutely wrong. And then I was, well, what is going on? So I thought, oh, the cells are much weaker in the embryo. I don't know why, but they are weaker. So what I said is, now I have to change the surface tension. And obviously, we go to the problem, how do you do that? So what we did is we engineer co-surfactants that are inside the drop. They attach to the surfactants that we had on the surface. They are dye blocks made of hydrocarbon and a tail of a fluorinated molecule. And these attach inside to the surfactants and make a fluorinated tail, which lowers further the surface tension. So by changing the concentration of this inside the drop, we can tune the surface tension. So then I put these droplets that with a six-fold difference in surface tension, and you can start seeing the deformations in vivo, and you measure these values with those drops that are much weaker, okay? And then you can ask, if they can generate the same forces, why is that they were not able to deform the same droplets in the beginning? And the reason for that is that when you measure the size of the cells in the embryo, the same cell, they are threefold smaller. They are very compacted in the embryo. And now you need to ask yourself, what are the stresses that deform a drop? If you have a drop and you try to deform the drop on a scale lambda, the forces that you need to deform this drop, the stresses, are of order gamma over lambda. This is the stress that you need. So if the cell is now three times bigger, or three times more, it makes a difference on the stresses that it can generate. So actually, you can calculate that and realize that the smaller cells that you have in vivo would not deform the original droplets with that surface tension.
When you make single cell computations, when you just look at one cell and you have like 10 rounds.
Right, so?
You said there is this length lambda, but next to it there is another cell which is the same length lambda.
Right.
So you have two lambda. So
That's a good point, actually. What happened, I didn't do it like this. I can show you. I had some slides, but I thought I was going to run out of time, so I didn't put it in. But we measure the deformations around the drop, the tick characteristic, and you can see that there is a characteristic length scale of deformations, which is the cell size, actually, essentially. And then you measure the cell size, and you find that in the embryo, it's much smaller. And it matches exactly the length scale of deformations that you observe from just measuring the length scale of deformation of the drop. So I can show you that, actually. I have these slides in another talk, but I can show you, right? You can see, actually, by analyzing that, the discrete nature of the you can see the stress, what I'm saying is that you can see the stress inhomogeneities around the droplet. This is what you're measuring, actually.
It's just a question of size. Why not you change the size?
Does not change the what? This is what we did. Oh, the drop.
We changed the surface tension.
No. We also changed sizes.
Oh.
We had a whole range of sizes.
Right.
And then this way, actually, if you plot.
If you
put
in terms of cell size.
Now, that's a good point. Let me show you. I thought actually it was not going to come up. So let me just try to. I don't know if it's going to be here. Sorry. Oh, no. Come on, that was only closed the little window. Oh, that's going to take long. Oh, let's see if I have it here. No. Anyway, I think I can plot it actually for you instead of like going to the top. Okay. And obviously now it's going to take ages. Anyway, I'm going
to
wait.
So if I try to change the shape of the table, my neighbor is doing the same. Both our effects will kind of add up.
Right. Yeah. You're right, actually. I'll show you in a second. I think actually that I understand that, but don't tell me that I don't have it here either. No. That's not here. I have to go to the previous talk at KITP. It's because if you look at the stress and anisotropy that you have, and you look at the length scale, it looks very much that it's like, because you, it looks that it's this. You can see, do you see Salsal junctions? It looks that the highest curvatures that you get them at the Salsal junctions, because you have the cortical tension of the cell is directed in the normal direction. You see, imagine there is a cortical tension here. So you're seeing actually the anisotropies in the drop shape are due to the anisotropies that you have because you have a Salsal junction. This is what you're picking up. This is what
it looks like.
Yeah, let me show you if this is done because it's a good point. I don't know what it is. Oh no, that's an old talk. I'll show you later. It's in the paper though. You can check it in the paper. So, anyway. Let me just finish, and then we can discuss more if you want. So what we've done, actually, it's we've developed this technique, actually, to measure the stresses, actually, and to decouple, that decouples the isotropic stresses and the anisotropic stresses, to measure the forces that cells do in living tissues. And we can do 3D reconstruction, and we can do 3D time. So now we're using this to measure in 3D and time as the tissues grow, having a field of droplets, actually the force fields during morphogenesis. You can also, if you don't have a confocal, one can also do 2D sections of the droplets and do a statistics on the entire tissue. You cannot measure locally what are the stresses, but one can get idea of the global forces. What I've shown you also is that the forces that we observe are myosin-2-dependent, so they are actively generated. And this was, by the way, something that I was very surprised. I was expecting that inhibiting myosin-2 would release some of the force, but the drops would be still a little bit different because of adhesion. And I'm not seeing that. Kind of indicating that the adhesion forces, stresses are weaker, or they require the active terms to be in place. Then, so we also... So I show you actually that the maximal stresses that the cells, the tooth mesenchymal cells were doing actually were the same in vivo that they were doing actually in cell aggregates. And finally, and this I didn't show you because it's exactly the point that you were discussing, that the largest mechanical inhomogeneities occur at the cell scale. When you change the size of the droplets and you check actually the typical characteristic scale of the formation at different sizes, you see a maximum that tells you that there is a scale in the mechanical inhomogeneities in the tissue. And that scale turns out that when you measure cell size, it's cell size. OK. So that's it. I want to thank, actually. So I started this work, actually. I did this in the lab of Don Ingberg, actually, at Harvard. Well, Mahadevan was not really involved in this, but he was my advisor on other topics, actually, related to cell shape at that point, actually. So I also want to acknowledge him. He helped me a lot. And then actually, these are the people that helped me develop the experiments. Tara helped me with the dissections of the mice. Sean helped me with injections. Ralph with the development of the surfactants. Jerome helped me with the imaging. And Dan with the transgenic mice. And finally, I want to thank you all for your attention. With cell adhesion, with ligands for cell adhesion receptors.
So they are presumably there's no tangential force
That's a good point. That's a good point. So Marangoni things. Let's go to Marangoni here because it's a very good point actually. So Marangoni is, you have gamma would be gamma zero, and I'm just gonna, oh, sorry, that should be plus over a square logarithm of one minus rho a square. So a very basic calculation, if you base it on just lattice gases on a 2D surface, fluid interface, and you have surfactants, is that you cannot see anything, is that it's this one here. But this gives you the order of magnitude of the surface tension reduction that you have. And you can see that with the variations that we observe, because we can observe the binding side of this surfactant, we don't see any variations. You can calculate this and compared to the base mode of the base value of the surface tension, and you can see that it's nearly negative.
It's about 0.1 millinewtons per meter.
Yeah. However, there is an interesting issue that we are fixing now, that you need to think that when you actually grab, so the reduction of surface tension is a 2D pressure on the surface of the drop, right? It's an entropic effect. Now, the interesting part is that if the cells adhere and were to adhere a lot on the surface of the drop, that blocks the movement of these surfactants. And then you don't have an entropic reduction. It changes the entropic reduction. So what we do now is we buffer the surface of the drop with two types of surfactants. One's kind of freely mobile that buffer the surface tension, and the others that allow the cells to adhere. Because one has to be careful with that. At that moment, actually, it didn't do that, actually. And I think that the, if you calculate what is the surface density of adhesion molecules, it's not that high, so I think. But I want to be on the safe side, so we are now using two types of surfactants, yeah. And that's a good point. Yeah. By the way, these, going to this point, I mean, these are fluid droplets,
yeah.
So they don't resist shear. And this is an important point for, if you want to think about the forces that cells generate in vivo, because they actually can apply shear forces in vivo. So what we're doing now is like also making droplets with a crust, like kind of making solid interface so that the cells can also apply shear forces. That's a little bit more complicated. But we're working on this. We're working on having sensors that can decouple all these different things. Yeah.
So related to the shear stuff, in embryos in vivo, they have the tissue is moving itself. So do you have to worry about the flow? Again, in principle, you could think that there is a contribution coming from the motion and the flow that they
kind of
also
induce. Right. Actually, to be fair, if there is a shear
flow at the tissue scale,
we can pick it up. Not with these droplets, but with larger droplets, we pick it up. And the key point is because there is a difference in the speed of the tissue. If there is a shear stress, there is a difference across the drop. And then that elongates the droplet. Actually, that was a Taylor like 100 years ago. Okay, so we can understand the formations of a drop in a shear flow, and actually you see that in the tissue. So
but
you can pick shear.
From the ones you pick.
Exactly. So you that's a good point. So you if you have droplets that are too small, then you don't pick up this mold. Yeah.
It's clear to me that you can measure some differential spacing of forces. And you can say it pulls more on this place than on the other place. But not clear to me the absolute value seems to be a bit more complicated.
The absolute value of
the spacing of forces. Because if you imagine that you have, say, a big droplet and many cells pulling, all of them pull, but the drop is still circular, right?
Because
you can be able to see this pulling force if it's not somehow pulling more in one place on the other.
What I'm saying is that we can measure
isotropic
and isotropic. What you're talking about is the total stress.
You need this to somehow say my stresses or my forces.
1.5.
What you're saying is this: there is a minus a pressure, a tissue pressure, plus the delta sigma and n that we're measuring. This is what we measure. This we don't know. But I can tell you that it's in the same order of magnitude because now we can measure that. It's in the same ballpark. So now we know actually how to measure this. Actually, we're
developing a thing to do that
in vivo, inside the tissue. But you can actually, in epithelial layers, you can do this. I don't know if you can see it, but you have a drop here. You have an epithelial layer. The drop. You have a spherical cap. And in the spherical cap, so you see this part? So now you can calculate the isotropic stress from the radius of curvature of the cap. And if you do that, actually, we did that in a drop that was in the epithelium.
with a spherical cup, and you can measure actually the value of the pressure in the epithelium. I don't know how it's going to be inside the tissue, but we're working on that actually, not with a droplet, because you cannot actually measure the deformation, the isotropic deformation of the droplet, but with other techniques to get there.
It's probably not relevant for some smooth recurve droplets, but I mean, if you have some point where it's really strongly deformed, bending, the contribution, the bending energy could also make a contribution. I mean, that's probably easy to estimate.
Right, but bending at this scale, you really would need to deform a lot the droplet actually to get bending here. So the bending can come from this surfactant layer. It could be that you have a bending.
You say you have a pretty massive surface layer, right?
What do you understand by massive?
more massive than just a lipid layer, right?
Yes. Yeah, there is a PEG layer, there is the streptavidin, fluorescent streptavidin, then there is a digital molecule. So. Yeah, it's about,
so that means you have
it's about five nanometers. Five nanometers.
High lipid bilayer scale.
That's a good point. I mean, it may be at the lipid bilayer scale, but I've never seen tubes being pulled out of these droplets, which you would naturally expect if you had a bending rigidity. Maybe there's a competition then actually between bending and so if you were to pull the drop then and there was a bending rigidity, you would have the competition between bending and stretching, and that sets a length scale that there's a length scale of tubes in vesicles, but we don't see that. You see actually something cells actually attach, like sucking on the droplet and taking up little droplets. Very little meaning on a micron scale, which means that the forces for that are like one to two orders of magnitude larger than this. But I've never seen any indication of bending. It could be. Now what we have in the lab actually is an interfacial rheometer. So we are now measuring the rheology of this layer to see if really we can, I mean, we can. There is a bending rigidity associated with that. But we didn't do that at this moment. That's it?
Is there anything we could learn if you put a vesicle instead of a drop?
So that's everyone asked me. Actually, no. The next.
Talking about reducing the surface tension. I don't know if that
exactly. Actually, the next question I always ask is like, why don't you put polyacrylamide like spheres in there? Actually, also. So the reason for the vesicles is the vesicles have an ill-defined surface tension. The effective surface tension depends on the shape of the vesicle, and it's a little bit trickier to analyze that situation. The drops are, you saw that the relation between the stresses and the drop deformation is just a linear spring. It's just as simple as it gets, right? But if you have a vesicle, it's way more complicated. And on top of, and if you had a rigid particle, an elastic particle, then it's very complicated, because if you have small deformations and it's linear elasticity, you're kind of okay, maybe. But if you have, you deform considerably the probe, then you would have nonlinear elasticity, and that would be a nightmare to trace back these stresses from the deformation. So this is why we use droplets. I know maybe somebody else is going to do little vesicles.
Thank you.
Thanks.